What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hi everyone, Connor Boyle here. Just a reminder, you can take your Intelligence Squared experience deeper with Intelligence Squared Premium. You'll get an ad-free feed, one early episode per week, two bonus episodes per month, discounts on Intelligence Squared Plus, priority access to our live in-person events, and access to our premium monthly newsletter. Sign up at iq2premium.supercast.com. Thanks for all your support. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On today's programme, we're joined by the journalist and author, Anthony Satin. He'll be discussing how the world we know today has been shaped by the nomads of the past. Anthony Satin is a contributing editor to Condé Nast Traveller and a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. His new book, Nomads, the Wanderers Who Shaped Our World, examines how the way in which we live today has been influenced in part by the ancient cities and also the historical nomads who travelled between them. Our host for today is Rosamund Irwin, media editor of the Sunday Times. Let's join Rosamund now.
Anthony, what I wanted to start with was addressing why you think contemporary historians have overlooked nomadic populations so much and why it's so important to address this balance.
Well, firstly, I don't think it's just contemporary historians. I think it's all historians have missed the nomadic element in our story. And the reason for it is, well, there's several reasons. One of them is quite simple, and that is nomads have not generally kept records. So it's, even if you wanted to write a history, and I know this from, you know, personal experience having written this book, it's very, very difficult to gather the information. But, you know, there's a great line from an Oxford and Princeton historian describing history as a path picked through ruins. And, you know, it's very evocative. It sort of talks about, it invokes sort of something like a highway of history. And it starts with, you know, early monuments, and it comes through to the great skyscrapers and things of today. And this is the point I started with. I thought, well, but that means there's no place for nomads unless they are, because they tend not to build monuments, unless they're the ones who destroyed those monuments, which means that in our conventional histories, nomads are generally presented as the destroyers. And that's, you know, well, it's just not true. And, you know, there's a reason for doing this now, this book. I mean, I think we're living in such an interesting period of history. I mean, I'm not naturally a historian. I'm not an academic. I don't, you know, have a chair in history, nomadic history at Oxford or something. But I was fascinated by this omission. And I sort of, the more I looked into it, I mean, there are, of course, you know, some serious books on the nomad empires of the Central Asian steppes, and, you know, and obviously lots of books on the Aborigines and nomads in Africa. But as a general history, as a sort of, you know, as a broad sweep, it's simply not there. And I thought, well, that's extraordinary and wonderful, and I therefore have to write it.
There's a fascinating study right at the end of the book that you discuss about babies and the importance and sort of how ingrained walking actually is in all of us. I wonder if you could tell us about that research. I think I was probably particularly interested, as I have a young son who was only there while being carried, you know, as I walked. So I thought this sure. Particularly resonated with me, but it's really interesting.
Well, it's great because this does come right at the very end. So it's a good, I was holding you to the end of the book. Yes, it's research that was actually done in the 60s and 70s in London into the effect of movement on children, on babies. And it was discovered that, you know, a baby left to scream on its own, the heartbeat will get up to about 200 beats a minute. And if you pick it up, and you know, and it, as a parent, you and I both know this, you pick it up and start rocking it from side to side, it will calm down a bit. What the research discovered was that if you rock it at 60 beats a minute, the heartbeat will come, well, firstly, it'll stop crying, and the heartbeat will come right down. And the and also that if you tilt the angle slightly, then also the child, the baby will calm. And the inference from this is that this is a sort of throwback from a time, some sort of memory muscle we have, of a time when we were all living on the move. And therefore, when you were a baby and you were strapped to your mother's back and she was on the move, you were safe. And you were moving, which meant that you were in a pack, and therefore you were doubly safe, and therefore you could stop crying, because you know crying is a panic response. So yes, that's and it ties into something else I write about in the book, which is research that was done in the States more recently into genetic variants. And these researchers from Northwestern University in the States discovered one particular variant of a gene that they identified in successful nomads in a tribe in East Africa. And obviously there are more, some nomads are more successful than others. And these were nomads who were, you know, who were leading the tribe, who were better fed, who had larger families because they could afford to look after them. And they found this same variant in children who were diagnosed with learning disorder in the United States, with attention deficit disorder. And they're scientists, so they obviously were reluctant to make the obvious conclusion, and that is that there's a link between these two, and that maybe these children are simply not happy or succeeding because they're in the wrong place. And to put them in a classroom is maybe not to bring out the best in them. If you put them into a different environment, and maybe into a nomadic environment, that they would thrive. And the suggestion behind that is that 12,000 years ago, which is where my book opens, we all lived on the move, and our brains were programmed in a completely different way. We needed different skills and different instincts and different responses. And now more than 50% of us live in urban environments. And obviously there's a huge toll on ourselves to live in that way. And 12,000 years in human story is but yesterday. So that maybe many of us have simply not reprogrammed.
Of course, there are actually still some nomadic populations today. And you start the book in the Zagros Mountains in Iran, watching the annual migration of a tribe there. One thing you say is that a sort of universal issue for nomadic people is that governments put pressure on them to settle. Could you just explore what those pressures are and why they come sort of so into conflict with how essentially us settled people live our lives?
Well, there's, on a governmental level, I mean, I've seen this all over the Middle East, which is where I've spent a lot of my adult life. And people who move around and have no fixed abode are very difficult to control. And so they're very often, you know, the story is in Syria, I heard that all the Bedouin women were prostitutes. In Egypt, you hear that the Bedouin men are smuggling drugs, or in Libya, they're smuggling arms, or which they may well have been actually recently. But, or, you know, there's always some sort of negative thing associated with them. And so governments also like to tax people. And so they hold out these twin carrots for the young and the old. And that is, if you want to educate your child, and if you're living in the 21st century, you generally do, then you're going to have to put your child into school. And so, for instance, with the nomads, the Bakhtiari that I write about at the beginning of the book in the Zagros Mountains in Iran, the whole family doesn't have to stop moving, but the children are put into a government-sponsored boarding school. So that's one side of it. And the other side is for the elderly. You want healthcare? You need to be effectively sort of signed up with a doctor, with a clinic. And therefore, again, it's another way of getting people to settle and control them. But it's interesting because there are some places, obviously, where it's in the government's interest to have people still moving. So, for instance, in Iran, there is a ministry that looks after nomadic affairs. And there are still a lot of nomads, simply because the landscape simply doesn't allow for much agriculture. It's a very, very harsh, it's either mountains or it's desert, most of Iran. And so for most of Iranian history, Persian history, the people who lived there were nomadic. I think the nomads today produce about a third of all Iran's meat. and that's what this migration is all about. They go in search of grass. Well, there isn't enough grass to keep the herds going through the whole year. So they have their summer and their winter grazing, and they move between the two.
Tell us more about the Scythians, who are people you cover in the book. Obviously, an ancient Eastern Iranian equestrian, nomadic people. But one we know or hear or learn a lot less about, for example, at school, than other ancient populations.
Yes, they're just not on the curriculum. Well, not yet. I mean, they might be. And obviously, I'm trying to put them onto the curriculum. But there was an exhibition in the British Museum, had a big show about 5 years ago of the Scythians. And obviously, I went to, and it had beautiful, very sophisticated jewellery. You know, everything about them was fascinating and beautiful. But there was also a conference of all the sort of Scythian experts from around the world at the same time as that exhibition. And just to show you the difficulty of trying to write about these people, trying to study them. So 3 days of conference and papers and whatever. And then what the reality is that we don't even know what they called themselves. We don't know that they called themselves Scythians, but they came off there's this sort of huge steppe land that runs more or less from Hungary to Manchuria to China. And in the western part, so from here to Kazakhstan, to the Altai Mountains, it's long, flat, grassy, very good for grazing, very good for horses. And it's a bit harsher because it's higher up Mongolia, and you know that's a much harder landscape. But this is the great steppe corridor that links the east and the west of Eurasia, the sort of the great landmass of the world. And one by one, that because people who live on this this steppe have always been nomadic, they move down because of climate change or a warming or a cooling that makes it impossible for them to live up there. So they've come down either into China or into the West, sometimes into Hungary, sometimes down into the Middle East, or sometimes down into Pakistan and down the Indus River. And when they come, they bring innovation, they bring fresh blood, they bring trouble for the people who are living there already, because they need to settle. And one by one, you have lots and lots of tribes over thousands of years moving down. And the Scythians were one of them. And what we know about the Scythians is that more or less from the western part of from Turkey onwards to the east, to about maybe into Kazakhstan, they controlled a vast amount of territory. They and their friendly other friendly nomadic tribes, and from the middle of there to China, to the Great Wall of China, there was a tribe called the Xiongnu. Again, we don't know what they called themselves, because they certainly didn't call themselves Xiongnu, because it means in Chinese sons of slaves or something like that. So again, we know very little about them. But they, from about 600 BC to about 300 of the current era, there appears to be this vast territory between the Roman world and the Chinese, or the Han Chinese world, controlled by a confederation of steppes. And I actually call it an empire, although we don't know much about their administrative structure. But it seems that because you find similar, I mean, one of the things they have left behind are these huge graves, which are sort of massive mounds, some of them a couple of hundred meters around, with lots and lots of, the biggest of them have a lot of horses that were sacrificed when the dead person was being interred. Sometimes you have two or three different burials in them. And you have women as well as men being buried in grand style, with gold, with cauldrons, with Chinese silks, with animal furs, and also with porcelain. And so and you find this in east and west of this huge steppe. So the suggestion is that these people were in touch with each other and trading with each other. And they were connecting, although neither the Romans or the Chinese acknowledged this, that they were connecting these two worlds. They were the conduit for not just goods, but ideas that travel between East and West. But the story we get from the historians is one, well, the Chinese built the Great Wall to try and keep the Xiongnu out. And the Romans tried to build a similar wall in the very far east of their empire to keep the Scythians and others out. And of course it fails, because walls don't work. We know this. And actually what these people wanted were open markets, because they wanted to trade. They had things they couldn't produce on the steppes that they needed from settled people. And this is one of the themes that runs through the book, and it's one of the big big facts of the book, and that is that throughout history, although our history books, if they write about nomads, they present them as people who destroy things. Actually, most of history, settled and nomadic people lived very happily together because they were mutually dependent. They needed each other. And they needed to trade. So the happy times are when the markets are open and the nomads can come to the markets, which are invariably set up by settled people, and trade their goods. And when you have unhappy times, for instance, the Roman Empire falls when the Huns arrive. Well, the Huns arrive because the Romans keep closing the trading posts.
You do address one other very unhappy time in the book, which is the Black Death. And obviously there is the trade routes are one of the elements of that. There's always a habit of blaming outsiders for disease and, you know, across human history. How often were nomadic people, were they often blamed? Is there an element of that?
Oh, they were always blamed. There's a wonderful description from Sumer from about 2000 BC, or maybe even earlier, 2,500 BC, where there's a Sumerian princess who's fallen in love with a nomad, and her friends are trying to persuade her not to do this. You can't marry him because, you know, he's not one of us, and you can't marry him because he wears leather. And you can't marry him because he eats raw meat. And, you know, and there's this sort of long litany of things a similar list to things you might hear today. And he doesn't know how to say his prayers properly. And when he dies, he won't be buried in a mausoleum. But the sort of, and you get these stories coming out from deep, deep history. Think of Cain and Abel. It starts with that, really, the mistrust of the settled, of the nomadic. Down to our own time. I mean, in our own time, you know, we're very worried about travelers and others. Who are these people? Why have they come? Where have they come from? What do they want from us? And so, yeah, that plays the whole way through. And sometimes there's very good reason to be anxious about the arrival of nomads. And I'll come on to the Mongols in a minute. But another story about the Scythians before we're done with them, because the Scythians get bad press for killing the great Persian king, the founder of the Persian Empire, Cyrus the Great. But the story that is recorded by Herodotus and others is very clear, and that is that the Scythians then had a queen, which is to their credit. They definitely allowed women equal status in many, 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 many affairs. And the Scythian queen, Cyrus is invading Scythian land, and the Scythian queen says, don't do it, don't cross the river, you don't need to do this, we don't need to fight. And he says, well, he wants the Scythians to pay respect to him because he thinks he's the ruler of the world. And the Persians do cross the river, and a great fight ensues, and Cyrus loses his head. And so the Persians were not very impressed with that. And so jump forward about 50 years to Darius the Great, the next great Persian emperor. And he tries to do the same. He invades Scythia. And by then there's a Scythian king. And this is something I love. So the Scythians just won't confront this enormous Persian army, which might be 700,000, might be more. They just keep moving away. They just move across the land further and further until eventually, and Darius's supply lines are getting more and more stretched, and winter is coming, and he's getting worried. So he sends a very fast messenger after the Scythian king to say, why won't you fight? I mean, either fight or pay me tribute as your lord. And the Scythian king says, why would we fight? We have no cities that you might destroy. We have no crops that you might burn. We have nothing to worry about. And so they just kept on moving. And eventually the Persians gave up and went home. And it's sort of, you know, it's just a brilliant clash of not of civilizations, but of ideas of how one might be. The Persians moving with all their gold and glitter and women and heavy baggage or whatever, and the Scythians just lightly moving ahead of them. They think, we don't need to fight. It's okay. But jump. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, you prompted me to ask about Genghis Khan. So obviously,
yes.
Whose name really does resonate, and obviously known as being a sort of a vengeful killer and also sexually. Well, prolific, I suppose, would be a word.
And what
do we misunderstand in that portrayal of Genghis Khan? And is there much more that we should know?
There's a yes, there's much, much more we should know. Genghis Khan, you know, comes out of a small tribe in Mongolia. If you've read Colin Thubron's The Amur River, which came out last year or this year, then the Amur River, which is the 10th longest river in the world, starts. It's originally called the Onon River, and that's the heartland of the Mongol people. And that's where Genghis Khan comes out of, but always goes back to Karakorum, the famous Mongol city, is not far from there. But he comes out of this small tribe, and he's fighting, but he has a vision, which is sort of inspired by, he's a sky worshipper, he worships the Sky Father, which is a typical Indo-European religion. You worship all the elements, and the Sky Father, which then plays out in Christianity as our Father who art in heaven, he's still in the sky, Genghis Khan has the idea that it was in his destiny and ordained by the Sky Father that he should rule the world. And so he built from his very, very small power base of sort of several hundred people, a coalition until there are millions of them. And he builds this Mongol empire, which stretches from China again to the West. And he becomes the most powerful person in the world. This is 1100s into the early 1200s of our time. And, you know, think about English history at this time. I mean, it's not our most glorious period. We've come out of the Dark Ages, but the Crusades are going on, and Renaissance is still a long way in the distance. So you have this man who has done what nobody else in the world is doing at that time, and he creates the largest empire the world has ever seen. Enormous. And he does it the way that it was done at that time, and probably still is done, if you look at what's happening to the east of Europe at the moment, with warfare. And, you know, warfare was not pretty. The Crusades were not pretty. What our great Christian warriors did was not pretty. But there's a reason for this sort of absolute horror blitz approach that Genghis Khan has when he's approaching people. He always offered peace. You know, give in to me and I won't destroy your cities, and, you know, and you can pay your tribute and you can go around living as you lived before. And if people resisted, then he attacked. But it had to be quick, because the Mongols were very bad at siege warfare, because they're nomads, and they have, you know, Mongol fighter has several horses. That's a lot. If you've got hundreds of thousands of riders, that's millions of horses. What are they going to eat? So you can't stay in one place very long. They have to keep on moving. And so the idea of, you know, why he killed so many people in certain places was that, firstly, they hadn't accepted his offer of paying tribute to him. And so he went to war, and he went to war as quickly and as savagely as he could, so that the next people down the line would understand that it was in their interest to give up very quickly. But it was also in the interest of the nomads as well. Not that I'm an apologist for Genghis Khan. He did kill millions of people. But also great things came out of this. You know, this is a time when most of Europe is absolutely closed. But what Genghis Khan sets up, and is followed 100 and something years later by one of his successors, Tamerlane, or Tamburlaine, as we sometimes call him, the great Emir Timur, who's comes out of the same Mongol stock, is a sort of a massive open Central Asia, open for trade. This is the beginning of this really great flourishing of the Silk Roads, so linking China with the Mediterranean. They're open for, so you have freedom of movement, you have freedom of conscience as well. I mean, he's not interested in, it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian, a Muslim. And Karakorum, the city that he found, well, in fact, in his own life, it's really just a tent city, but one of his successors builds it up into a proper settled town city. It has churches of various denominations, it has mosques, and they're still praying to Sky Father and to the elements, and basically it didn't matter. And then they become Buddhists, and it doesn't, that's of no interest. Everybody is welcome. So the important thing is free movement and free trade. So they made trade tariffs very low. They were sort of early Keynesian economists, I think. They wanted to see their money moving. There's a moment where one of the Mongol Khans, who we all know, Kublai Khan, goes into the imperial treasury and sees all this gold and silver and says, what's this doing? Give it away. It has to keep moving and it'll come back to us, you know, sort of tenfold. So that was very much the, and they set up, following the Roman example and before that, the Persian example, they set up highways. I mean, not obviously not paved as we would understand them, but clear routes the whole way across Central Asia, where it was said that if you were a young girl, you could walk with a gold bowl on your head and nobody would trouble you. Well, they wouldn't trouble you because the punishments were so extreme. And you know, later on, they build a series of hostels where if you have the right coin, if you've been approved to stay in the hostels, you're going to get bed and board and a fresh mount. And if you have the golden coin, you're going to get silk sheets. You're going to get a real feast. It's a 5-star hotel. And you know, this side of Genghis Khan is just not known at all. And out of this comes, you know, out of all these Mongol movements, east and west, does come the Black Death, which is absolutely devastating, obviously. Although it's still not quite clear where it came from, but it may well have come. I mean, it certainly came from somewhere in Central Asia, but also comes all of the foundations for the Renaissance, all of the ideas, and for instance, paper brought by Mongols from China, and gunpowder, which obviously the Europeans scale up and turn into lots and lots of deadly weapons, whereas the Chinese initially had it for their religious festivals, and the compass. You know, all these are brought as long, long time before the taming of the horse, riding horses and the bridle and the chariot. All those came off the steppes brought by nomads.
Well, I wanted to touch on that because this is a theme throughout the book, that the ability to ride was a revolution, the equine revolution. And perhaps we don't think enough about quite how much that changed things.
Well, it's interesting. We're now moving away from the combustion engine slowly, but we will, you know, as our means of transport. And Wilfred Thesiger, who himself was rather partial to nomads, who I went to talk to in his old age when I was just beginning to travel, used to call the combustion engine the sort of curse of mankind. And he spent his last years trying to find people who weren't touched by it. But if you think the combustion engine will maybe have lasted 150 years by the time it's extinct, the horse was the mode of transport for thousands and thousands of years. The New York Fire Brigade was still using horses to pull their fire trucks at the beginning of the 20th, beginning of the last century. So, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of years. It's the most successful means of transport, apart from our own feet, that we've ever had. You know, and that's, you know, that came off the Eurasian steppe, and it was brought by, well, firstly achieved by nomads, and also brought by nomads. So yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's fascinating, and there are some great books on the horse that to be read that are in my bibliography, and that's the whole story of how it shaped our world.
Hi everyone, it's Connor Boyle here. If you don't already know, we've launched Intelligence Squared Premium. It's an exciting new way to take your Intelligence Squared experience to the next level so you can make the most informed decisions about the issues that matter in the company of the world's greatest minds and speakers. Crucially, it lets us produce even more amazing podcasts for you, as well as running some more live events and big debates. This is now available on all podcast players, including Spotify, for just $4.99 a month. Sign up now at iq2premium.supercast.com. That's IQ, the numeral 2, premium.supercast.com, or see the link in the description. Thank you for all your support.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Now, I made you an apologist a little bit for Genghis Khan. Attila the Hun. Let's do both.
Attila.
There's a really interesting line in the book that I loved, which is that he recognized that a ruler of an empire must build a house, banqueting hall, and council chamber that his were made of wood and so could be dismantled. So he's going around sort of setting it up everywhere. So there's a challenge here for him of balancing all those sort of the mobile traditions alongside the need for a capital city to have a proper empire. Tell us about Attila. Yeah.
Well, Attila is, he was probably born in Hungary. His tribe came off the steppes, but he himself was brought up more or less in a settled environment. But he's certainly part of the nomadic tradition, and he chose to identify himself and to live in a nomadic way. So as you say, he recognizes he needs a capital. But first of all, he only comes west of the Danube, which was one of the sort of frontier points of the Roman Empire. And this is in the early 400s of our era, because of global warming, climate change. And there was a problem of tribes on the steppes, one after the other, the Goths, the Huns, and lots of others came because of this need for grazing. And they cross over the Danube. The Roman emperor at the time, Valens, was very keen for them not to, and then recognized he couldn't stop them. So he allowed, for instance, the Goths initially to settle in Thrace in Greece. But the problem for Attila was he didn't necessarily want to come into the Roman Empire. He wanted to trade. And the Romans kept closing the trading posts. And each time they did that, he would invade and cause immense distress and destroy vast numbers of Roman legions. And then he would get what he wanted. But he didn't necessarily want the Roman Empire. I mean, not initially. And so when, each time he'll go another incursion into the Roman Empire and he'll destroy a city and then he'll pull back to his land, because what he wanted was an open market. And eventually more and more he wanted tribute, because he recognized that he was stronger than the Romans. He could defeat the great Roman armies. And so the tributes get bigger and bigger. And there's a wonderful description from one of the Roman ambassadors to a man called Priscus, who goes to see Attila. And so we have firsthand description of this great ruler. And what strikes Priscus is that Attila is a family man. He's presented, with his son sitting beside him, and he's clearly very affectionate to them. His wife is the only fixed building in the entire city of Attila, which still hasn't been found. We rely on Priscus's description for it. Was the bathhouse that Attila built for one of his wives, or his chief wife, which couldn't be dismantled. I think that was out of stone, but everything else was, you could take it down and move with it. But he's clearly a man who, Priscus sits there thinking, wow, this is a man who's famous for his savagery, and yet he's actually quite modest. He controls a large chunk of the world. He's immensely wealthy. And Priscus is given a gold platter to eat off, and everybody else is eating off gold, and they're all, they're all eating fancy food. But Attila is there with his wooden bowl eating straightforward meat, straight out of the nomad world, drinking fermented mare's milk. And, and he's a nomad at heart. And he only gets pulled further and further into the Roman world because the Romans keep on opposing him and won't give him what he wants, which is the right to trade. So eventually, he effectively brings down the Western Roman Empire and reduces the Eastern one around Byzantium, Constantinople, to a very small part. But it's interesting because had he lived a little bit longer, Attila, he may well have settled somewhere. He never lived to take Rome. He defeated another massive Roman army in a sort of devastating battle. But then he died. And I think, because this is the case with several of them, I think he died after another, because he took another bride and another massive bridal banquet and night in bed with a younger woman and had a heart attack. I think that was the end of Genghis Khan. But had he not done that, had he lived, he may well have taken Rome, and had he taken Rome, he may well have settled there. But up until then, there was this sort of unfinished business, so he wasn't going to settle. He was restless. He still had things to do.
Now, we're coming up to when we'll switch over to questions. We've only just started. Well, I haven't even touched on the Native Americans, and you can
no.
book about Benjamin Franklin, the founding father, and puzzled why people wanted to live in that way. What happened when, the founding fathers met the Native Americans in terms of these very different lifestyles? And was that, obviously we know there was a huge disaster for the Native Americans, but the nomad lifestyle was a real clash.
It was. And obviously not all of the Native Americans were nomadic, but many of them were. But it's fascinating because Benjamin Franklin, who's living in the settlement of Pennsylvania, can't understand why settlers who've been captured by the Native Americans and live with them for a while and then being brought back into the settlement won't stay. Given the first opportunity, and this is not just men, but women as well, they'll go back into what he called a wandering life. The reverse applies as well, and that is that Native American children who are being offered free education in the great schools and settlements were very loath to come. And there's a meeting between the Native American elders and the elders from the settlement. And the Native Americans say, well, we sent some kids to you for an education once, and when they came back to us, they were good for absolutely nothing. Why would we do it again? And Franklin is fascinated because he said, with all the advantages of arts and sciences, why is this the case? And it comes down to the fact he realizes you have to work a lot harder and longer to make your living in a settlement than you do out in the natural world with the people who move around. And obviously, he's clearly from the day he was born, he was going to work every moment, every day till he died. And he achieved enormous things. But he doesn't understand there are people who would just be quite happy just to hang out and live well. And he just doesn't get it at all. So it's a complete misunderstanding on both sides.
Let's turn to, we've got some great questions. So I'll start with Isabel's question. Do you think that the creation of settled civilizations was essentially a mistake? Would we be happier and healthier if we still lived in small groups on the hoof? We might be happier, according to what you've just said.
Well, we might be healthier as well. That's for sure as well. Would we be? Now, I think there are some people who would be much, much happier on the move. And the challenge now, I mean, there are vast numbers of people, for instance, in the United States who live in what they call wheel estate rather than real estate. They live out of a truck, a van, or whatever. And they're really, it's really a counterculture. And the film Nomadland touched on that. So these are people who literally are rootless, although they do gather at several places in several fixed times of the year, sort of as all tribes tend to do. But would we be happy? Yeah, it really depends on who you are. I mean, some of us have clearly evolved. I mean, I know my mother would have been absolutely miserable. I mean, you know, grass was something of a challenge for her. So you know, no, she needed somewhere where her heels were not going to sink into the ground and where there were no creepy crawly things. Nomad life, and also she liked to travel with a lot of luggage. So nomad life would not be for her. But I think, you know, and this is one of the really big ideas behind the book, and that is, you know, we are living in a time of immense social, cultural, political change. You know, that, and I think that the world that came into being at the time of the Enlightenment is, you know, this Western dominated world is coming to an end, and we're on the way to something else. And it might be that there are ideas that we can draw down from a lighter way of living, from a living in tune with the natural world, which nomads are obliged to do because they're absolutely at its mercy, and which we in cities find very easy to forget. You know, you go to the supermarket and you only notice where things come from when they're not there. It's like, what do you mean? And then you realize that Brexit stopped the supply of French cheese or something, or whatever it was. But otherwise, we don't even have to think about these things. And I think a lot of people would be much happier living a simpler life on the move. Yes.
But one thing that you do say in the book, there's a sort of theme across different populations where it's sort of soft land breeds soft men. And they have this idea that, you know, the third or fourth generation, when they start settling behind walls, they give in to luxury and then they lose touch with the people. So there's two things there. If we had a more nomadic lifestyle, would we have a more equal society? And then the flip side of that is there is bits of this life that are really, really hard, surely.
Yeah, there are. And this idea you've mentioned is from the Arab philosopher Ibn Khaldun, 14th, early 15th century. And he believes that he's an Arab, so he looks at the Arab Empire and he looks further back into deep history, and he's seen kingdoms, he's living in North Africa, come and go, and they've all been founded and initially by nomadic peoples. And so he divides people into different categories, and he describes the purest people as the people who live in the desert because they are untouched by the needless desires of people who live in the city. And as you say, he describes, you know, that many empires are created by people who've come out of either the desert or the mountains or off the steppes and have that initial force, which is dissipated by settlement and by softened by palace life. And there, yes, as you say, three, four generations and things are on the slide. And also because you live in a settled place and in a palace, you lose touch with the people who gathered around you and allowed you to create the thing in the first place. And there's very much a sense in this of a renewal that carried on throughout the world. The world was effectively refreshed by nomads coming until we invented machine guns and things like that, which no amount of sort of nomad valor and vigor was going to get past, you know, cannons and the Maxim gun and things like that.
I love this next question, which I think I know what you're going to say. Are the superit who travel the world and never stay put anywhere very long the new nomads? Excellent.
Yes. Well, okay, the word nomad, very, very, very old Indo-European word, and it literally means, in its original form, nomos, means somebody who goes in search of pasture, or somebody who has the right to graze their herd on a particular patch of land. But, you know, we live in the 21st century, and as my book moves forward, I do shift the meaning of the word nomad. And yeah, there are people who live on the move now, who, you know, who digital nomads and others who are, I mean, okay, they're not grazing, they're not coming with their sheep or their goats or whatever, or their horses. But in many, many respects, they are living exactly that way. And there's a lovely story that Bruce Chatwin wrote about a man who he thought was a pure nomad. And that is, he was an English salesman who traveled around Africa with a suitcase, you know, flight to flight, hotel to hotel. And the only solid fixed point in his life was a box that was in a locker in London. And if he wanted to put something into the box, because the box was full, he would have to throw something away. And Chatwin thought, you know, this is a man not only who has something to teach us, those of us who acquire too many things to be happy, but also in terms of moving around. So yeah, I think, you know, I don't mind people calling themselves digital nomads or others. It's fine.
We haven't talked much about religion and how it interacts with nomadism. This question is sort of asking about that. Is there a particular kind of religion that nomads tend to follow? They obviously can't build temples or altars to their gods, and that's from Stella.
Well, they do. I mean, they do build shrines. And in fact, many of the shrines that then turn into temples that then turn into cities. And I'm thinking, for instance, of Ur in Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, or even Baghdad. These places were initially somewhere that nomads passed by and left a mark, because it was sacred for some reason that we can't maybe quite understand today, because we've lost that initial knowledge. And then they evolve and they become, wow, it's a temple, and then around the temple will evolve a village, a town, and a city. But I opened the book with, and this is quite contentious, with a place called Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which was built around 9,500 BC and is one of, if not the oldest, built stone monument in the world. Imagine a big circle of pillars that are about, T-shaped pillars that are about 10, 12 feet high, with two bigger ones in the middle. There's about 12 on the outside. And there's lots and lots of circles on a hillside. And it seems to have been that initially, this was a nomadic initiative because of something that we can't understand, something sacred in that place. So, and because they were almost all nomads were in touch with the natural world, and therefore with what they believed to be the spirits of the world, as we did in Europe until 1,000 years ago, we all would have watched the shadows as we moved across a field because of the spirits that would be living in it. I mean, that was a given with all humans. We did away with it. Many nomads didn't. They still have that sense of the sacredness of certain places. So yeah, I think that, you know, religion has been important. But as I mentioned, certainly with the Mongols and the sort of great Mongol Renaissance that precedes the European Renaissance, it doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, a Buddhist, or an atheist. It was not important. And there's a lovely story of a Christian friar going to see, I think it's Genghis Khan, and he's already been blessed by the Muslims, and it's like, okay, well, you might as well come and bless me as well. If it works, it works. It's fine.
You've actually got a question about the place in Turkey you mentioned. What do we know about the people who built it? And is it true that they're the same ones who buried it? And forgive me for not saying it. I was terrified I'd mispronounced it.
Göbekli Tepe. We don't know very much about it. It was only uncovered in the 1990s by a wonderful man called Klaus Schmidt, and in the late 90s he started excavating, and they're still excavating today. And they found other similar sites from the same sort of period in that area, and I'm sure there's a lot more to be discovered. So we really don't know very much about them, except my understanding is that they were people who moved, hunter-gatherers. Who were following the movement of game, because at that point all that area of Turkey, what's now Turkey, was savannah and woodland. So they would have been moving, and there's one particular place where this temple is, where Göbekli Tepe is, which is a gully. So if you were going to chase game into a trap, that would be a perfect place. And they found lots and lots and lots of game bones there from, you know, and then as things went on, they obviously ate everything there was to be eaten around there. And because they kept on coming back to it, because they were building this place. And then you have the beginning of cultivation. So Göbekli Tepe might actually be the place that the agricultural evolution starts, because the this first strain of domesticated wheat was found about 25 miles away.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, we've got a question from Marie Christine. I'm fascinated by the Scythians, and she's been to visit one of their burial sites. I wanted to ask if there are any descendants of the Scythians living today.
Oh, good question. Well, perhaps if there are any who are listening in, they could make themselves known to you now. Hands up, anybody who's a Scythian. I don't know. Yes, inevitably, genetically there must be. Obviously, as there are, you know, I mean, you mentioned Genghis Khan and his sexual proclivity. I can't remember, but there's a significant amount of his DNA has been spread around the world. So, there must be Scythian DNA in the world. So there must be.
Did nomads enslave other people?
Yes, everybody did. It depends what you call enslaving. I mean, they drove them forward into... In battle, you'd often use the captured enemies as to draw the first fire. And yeah, we have very good records of Timur or Tamerlane as he moved his way through the Middle East. And particularly this moment where I describe, which I talked about, where he meets Ibn Khaldun, this great historian and sociologist. And we know that a huge number of people were sent east by Timur. But these were people who had skills. Who had, you know, they were craftspeople, because he was building these beautiful cities of Samarkand and others in the east. And it was the same with Genghis Khan. And so, for instance, in Karakoram, in its first iteration, there was a famous Parisian jeweler who'd been captured and had been enslaved and sent to Karakoram, because all of the best workmen were going there, because that was effectively the center of the world at that point. It was the capital of the richest empire in the world, and so obviously they wanted to bring the best that they could get to it. But what was interesting is that a Christian priest from Europe goes and finds this Parisian jeweler and offers him, say, "I'll buy you your freedom." And he says, no, "I'm quite happy where I am, thank you." And I worked out, you know, he was being paid millions of pounds, the equivalent of millions of pounds today, to build beautiful things for the nomads. So he had started out a slave, and I'm sure that the story for many, many people was absolutely miserable. But some of them, with a lot of people, there was a desire to use the skills. It's the same with scholars, you know, the nomads are often accused of destroying libraries, but that's certainly not my understanding of it. They moved libraries, yes, and they moved a lot of the scholars, and particularly to do with astrology, astronomy, because they were very much directed by the movement of stars and signs and portents. So in the same way that London in the beginning of the 20th century, the world's great city, you know, we attracted all sorts of people. We didn't bring them as slaves, but we attracted them here. And it was exactly the same with the nomads, except, yeah, they were enslaved. I mean, the same way that most feudal people were enslaved as well.
We haven't talked too much about language. Christine Robinson asks, do nomadic people usually have their own unique language?
No. They may well have done a long, long time ago, but not anymore. No. They, the Bakhtiari, I mean, they had in Iran, who I had spent some time with, they had their dialect, but effectively they're speaking, they speak the same language as most other people in Iran.
You will disagree strongly with this question. Do you agree that some scholars have exaggerated the importance of nomads throughout history? Much recent DNA and archaeological evidence shows that demographic and linguistic change happened not so much through one group of people on the move invading the territory of another, but through trade and other forms of cultural contact.
Well, yes and no, because I think trade and those other forms of cultural contact very, very, very often happen because of the people who live between two fixed points. And I get excited about the Scythians and the Xiongnu because they are the mobile counterpart to the Han Chinese and the Romans. And they are the ones who move things from side to side. We don't know of any Chinese trader who ever made it to the Roman court. And we don't know of any Roman who made it to the Chinese court. And yet we know that they were trading with each other. I mean, I can't remember one of the might be Cicero or one of the great Roman writers complaining about how much of the national wealth is being spent on Chinese silk. So women can flirt and whatever. It happens because nomads are in between. And it's the same with what I call the Mongol Renaissance, this great flourishing. the Pax Mongoliana, the peace that they bring about is just as great and just as far reaching in terms of consequences for the world as the Roman one. And you know, they bring about the connection between East and West. They are the link between the world, and they wouldn't have happened with settled people. And so yes and no is my answer. I agree and I fully disagree. And I don't think you can, you can't overestimate the influence of nomads in global history, because it's mostly either ignored or completely played down and marginalized as these are bloodthirsty killers. So no, we need more.
Saul has got an excellent question that brings us up to the current day. Did you have any contact with modern day travelers and Roma when you were writing your book?
Travelers and Roma, no, I didn't. I assume you mean the European ones. No, my experiences are all in Africa and Asia, not in Europe. Although I did see some of the transhumants in southern France, where they move the herds between summer and winter pasture. But no, but I think that, firstly, there's a really a brilliant book that still applies from Isabel Fonseca about the Roma. And the title is something like Bury My Heart or something like that. And it's beautiful and wonderful. And I think she wrote it about 15 years ago, maybe longer, but it's still absolutely poignant and to the point. But I think, you know, that they're a good example of, and there are many, many others. I mean, obviously I could have gone on researching this book forever, for several more lifetimes. And everywhere I went, I met people who'd say, oh, you should come too. And for instance, I remember sitting in Isfahan in Iran, and I met a woman from Bulgaria who said, we still have nomads in the mountains who are still speaking Greek, and, you know, of the Greek of Homer. And if you come, I'll take you to meet them. And I think Paddy Lee Fermor wrote about them when he was traveling through Eastern Europe. But how much can you do? I mean, this book, it already took 8 years of my life. You know, it's enough. It's enough.
But do you think some of the same, I think what perhaps Saul was interested in, do some of the same themes apply in how we treat the traveller community in Britain and in other parts of Europe as how they've been treated across history?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely the same. And that is, you know, a mistrust and ascribing all sorts of terrible things to them, which... they're people. People everywhere do good things and bad things, and so I'm sure the Roma and travelers do as well. But they also do good things. But it comes out of this sense of, oh my God, why have they come? Why have they come here? What are they doing? And what, you know, when will they go? And governments here, I mentioned, you know, that in Iran that they're very keen, and I saw this in Egypt as well with Bedou, wanting to settle people, and that's what we want to do here. With ours. But I think there is an absolutely essential function that nomadic and mobile people perform for us who live between fixed walls. And I think we should recognise that.
I think that's a lovely place to end. My thanks to Anthony Satin, to our audience, and to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. For more information, go to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description. Thank you for your support.